This is part two of the special podcast edition of From the Ruins of a Greenhouse. I am your host, Matthias Olsson, from Campfire Stories. If you enjoy this work, like the films we produce that can be seen at campfire-stories.org, you might consider becoming a Patreon member. What that means is that you decide on a monthly amount that you don't mind parting ways with, say $2 or $5. It also probably means that you have to get your credit card out and spend a minute or so filling out a form, which I know can be pretty annoying. But on the other hand, you only have to do that one time. As a Patreon member, you get the inside track to new releases, and on some of the levels, you get to have your name in the credits of our films. Find out more at patreon.com/Matthias Olsson. That's patreon.com/MATTIASOLSSON. Look for a link in the show description. You run a school called the Orphan Wisdom School.
Yep.
And looking at that word orphan, I'm guessing, and you'll have a chance to correct me soon or pick it apart, what I'm saying. But I'm guessing it has to do with the fact that the people who are non-Indigenous to North America split with their lineages when they moved from Europe to North America. And I suppose here in this country, we're orphans also, even though the split happened a little bit further back in time when the Vikings were christened. I'm curious if this understanding of your use of the word orphan lines up with your idea for using it. Or your, yeah.
Sorry, if what lines up with my
use? Well, the way I characterized your use of the word orphan, if that is... if I understand correctly, why your school is called... I could also just say, why do you call your school Orphan Wisdom School?
And maybe you should have.
It's never too late to correct yourself.
That's it? True. That's true. Very good. He's very... He has good humor.
Why do you call your school the Orphan Wisdom School?
Ah. I don't know. No.
Well, could it be
could it be
the people of your continent... Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. Well... okay, here's why. First of all, America is not American. America is European. That's my overture, okay? Americans did not invent the notion of America. Europeans did. America is a European fantasy, which has never happened. And that it still lives in the realm of fantasy. So a couple of little details to mention to you. One, some of you may have heard of a French lesser nobleman named Alexis de Tocqueville. Anyone? Yeah. So he made a grand promenade across the North American landscape, as rich people can do in the very early days of the 19th century. He had servants and so on. And he was writing his observations as he went and published them at the end, which is one of those geezly long European book titles that I couldn't possibly replicate for you. But in it, he made the following observation, which is very French of him, I think you'll agree, but remarkably, hauntingly accurate. He said, America, perhaps the only place on earth that has gone from frontierism to barbarism without passing through the intermediate stage of civilization. Of course, hauntingly accurate, no? That's one. Here's two. Every day, the following event takes place. Without fail, many places on the North American continent. The people who look like me in North America wake up every day in the absence of what they lost because they or their immediate ancestors came there. not gained, not found, lost. Savagely lost. Irreparably lost. People who look like me, I'll say it one more time, wake up every day in North America in the absence of what they lost by coming. And indigenous people who don't look like me wake up every day in the North American continent in the presence of what they lost because we came. Now that's something I live with that you don't. That's a guess. But I'm suspecting it's probably the case. It's part of the unacknowledged, unauthorized history of this thing called America, that the consequences continue to roll, haven't exhausted themselves at all, not even close. So one of the great savageries of the American, the nightmarish elements of the American dream, is how relentlessly self-promoting and self-believing it is. But it's not very self-critical. Self-critical requires a degree of psychological but cultural maturity to achieve and to live with and to see the consequences of. And so I made a little school that intended to do all of that. And up until the COVID-19, it did. And I'm extremely proud of the fact that people came from all over the place, from 16, 17 years old to 83. Natalie was the oldest one, or 85, something like this. Very proud. Third story I'll tell you, and then, because it's your show. So I was in Ireland. Now, you may grant me the possibility that if I look like I come from anywhere ancestrally, well, it could be Ireland. If it's not here, it could be Ireland. So I was there, and I was teaching at a conference, and it was way out in the countryside. And I was checking out of the hotel. And the young woman who had obviously been to hospitality school, as so many people who work in that industry have been, you know, being professionally hospitable, which is a strange thing, isn't it? It doesn't quite come from here. It comes that there's a different kind of calculation involved in being professionally hospitable. Anyway, she was being professionally hospitable, which is to say austere in her way. Austere?
It's a tough one. Austere, anybody?
Yeah, okay.
You got that?
Like that.
You wrote it down?
So we were talking, and I said, so busy. Oh, God, she said, which means yes in Irish. I said, really? She says, oh, God, she says, the Yanks especially, she says, the place is tick with them. Now, tick is thick. Thick is slang for too many. Too many Americans is what she was saying. Ah, the place is thick with the Yanks, she said. And then the whole thing that she learned at hospitality school fell away. And she launched, for 5 seconds, she entered into a zone of ancestral prejudice so deep and so thick and so unconscious, it was breathtaking to watch it. It happened right here, right in front of me. And this is what she said. Ah, yes, the Yanks, she said. They're looking for it. We have it. And then she forgot herself and said, oh, God, I was sorry. Anyway, have a nice day. There it was. Fortunately, she'd seen my passport. She knew I was a Canadian. So I didn't come in for the same vitriol that the poor Yanks did. Not that she was wrong about any of it. She's completely right about all of it. But the notion that North Americans have to come over here to find themselves, as if you're waiting for us to come, as if you're waiting for us on the main street, you know, give us a handshake and a free meal or any kind of formal acknowledgement that our homelessness as North Americans is unnecessarily persistent in us, and that you can absolve us of this homelessness simply because you're at home. I mean, you've probably been on the receiving end of this kind of thing, I would guess. So I think you know what I'm referring to. So I'd made an orphan wisdom school to challenge the notion that orphans have no ancestry. I say that's not what orphan means. Orphan doesn't mean you have no parents. It means you can't get to your parents from here. You have something indirect you have to accomplish to begin to approach them. Yeah, and coming to Europe may not be the best way to do it. Not in our droves, not in those, God help us, tours and stuff. Oh, well, that was fun. The Yanks are.
So the very first time I was in this room, which at the time was a room, I was sitting over there, and Robin, who's here somewhere, met up with me, and we had some mate. And I was new to the area, and I had only heard of Undertalarna, and I was drawn to it, and he was very kind. And we sat down, and we had a chat about, like, just exchanging some thoughts and some ideas. And he, at one point, mentioned that I should check out this podcast called For the Wild. And so I wrote it down, and I went home, and I just picked a random episode and put it on. And there you were. The first time I heard your voice and heard of you was happened that way. And you were talking about totem poles, or totem poles. I don't know which one is correct.
Dodem is the original sound, with a D.
I was just wondering if you would talk about totem poles again, because that was just so beautiful when I was sitting there in my kitchen. I didn't know this man talking, and I didn't know the meaning of totem poles, and I didn't even know that it was called totem and not totem.
Right. Okay. Sure. Thank you for asking. Well, the word dodem comes from my little corner of the world. It doesn't come from the west coast of Canada in British Columbia, where you find all the totem poles. So the people who gave us the word dodem never made a totem pole in their lives, ancestrally or currently. There's no institution of carving such things, okay? So it's a misapprehension of the word, because totem, the way it's used today, it means something like, you know, like your favorite animal. Or, God help us, your power animal. Okay. Now, in fact, the word dodem is an Anishinaabe word. Anishinaabe is the self-designation of the people who are indigenous to where I live. And it basically designates a whole range of understanding. Now, it doesn't mean a single word or two or three words. It's a whole scheme of life. But I could approximate it for you with a couple of sentences. Now, they will say, those are my relatives. That's generally the word they would probably use in English, relatives. Now, you may hear the word relative and think it means, oh, that's everybody who's alive that you know. But they mean something much vaster than people that you knew before they died. Their understanding of relative is the understanding not of affinity. It's an understanding of sustenance, not affinity, sustenance, the verb to sustain. So that's the noun, sustenance. It doesn't mean just food, but it also means food. But it means how you nourish someone or something else across a whole range of nourishment requirements, not food explicitly or singularly. So here's what they say about it, and here's how they live it out. They say, now, do you see all those creatures or all those characters in that pole? Yes. Do you see a human in there? And the answer is, sometimes. And do they tend to be the biggest one there? The answer is, never. They tend almost universally to be the smallest in a long line. So this is their ancestry pole. And the human element is maybe 8% by volume of the understanding of who and where they come from. So I'll say it one more time then and finish the thought. This is not an understanding of where they feel comfortable or they feel at home. This is an understanding of how they came to be alive in this generation. Everything that had to be there before this generation to give this generation its life. So it's an acknowledgement of the fundament of sustenance, not fellow feeling. Some of these are what we would call mythic animals. Some of them are recognizable as animals in the current world order. And so this is where you get to wonder, how are animals part of your ancestral line? Because our imaginations are DNA afflicted, right? So we can't really imagine, except in a mythic sense, that we were sustained by anything except other humans from now till as far back as you can go. They would completely agree with you. And they would say, so then who kept alive the first human? Who sustained the first human in your line? And the answer would have to be an animal. Either literally by turning into food, or by turning into those things that become the necessities of life, like clothing and shelter and so on. In other words, an animal would more or less willingly grant to your ancestor's capacity to live. It wasn't in your ancestor's self-definition. It was granted to them by the animals that were alive at the time. That's what this is an acknowledgement of. This is an amazingly sophisticated philosophical and psychological understanding of dependence. It says dependence is the most healthy arrangement conceivable for humans who find themselves the most dependent beings. See? So I could sum the thing up by saying the beautiful thing about a dodem pole as a farmer is this. So I raise sheep on the farm. I shouldn't say I. Look what I do. I'm here. So somebody's obviously doing it for us. And as you may know, sheep require a lot of protection. Especially, we're very on the edge of wilderness where we sheep farm. And the other farmers around me say, oh, you're growing sheep for the wolves, are you? That's how they very, in an ornery fashion, say you don't have a chance. So far, so good. But maybe here's why. By that understanding of dodem, we are not the sheep's principal beneficiary. The wolf is the sheep's principal beneficiary. If the sheep was to make a totem pole, the wolf would be the central figure. Why? Well, you know, you don't have to be a farmer to know this, that the wolf sees to it that only the best and the brightest and the strongest and the smartest and so on, survive the wolf's predation. Correct? You follow this reasoning. You know it yourself. So the sheep would understand the wolf not as its principal blood enemy, but in this dodem fashion, would understand the wolf as the sheep's most trusted and enduring companion and relative. That their very health as a flock depends on the wolf being a wolf and doing the wolf's work. Now, a farmer comes in and says, no more. Dogs, fences, etc., right? So you prevent the wolf from being what the wolf is to the sheep. So the first consequence, almost universally, of domestication is a degradation in the health of the animal. It's not because... Oh, this is way too long now. It's not because domestication is inherently wrong. It's because it forgets the dodem. So, I'm telling you then that one of the ways to restore this understanding is for the farmer to occupy the position that the wolf formerly occupied, but was banished because of domestication. The farmer becomes the wolf in function. And that's what you do every fall when you go amongst the flock and you choose who will live and who will die in the next couple of weeks. And vegetarians, if you're offended by the story, Try to remember where your vegetables come from. Because the Dodem story is not a story about meat-eating people or animals only. It's an understanding about the matrix of how these things mysteriously work. And we imagine predation to be a consequence of intense hatred or vitriol or demonic possession. But if you've ever seen it, you realize that's not what it is. It's a kind of love, devotion to life that humans are, the urban humans at least, are very far away from now and find it exceedingly difficult to recognize.
Thank you very much. Anybody who is wondering how long are these two guys going to sit up here and chat for, I have three more questions.
Three?
So
I got to raise my rates.
Yeah. We'll talk about that. Actually, call my agent and we'll figure it out. The next question, I put little headlines.
Wait, I got to stretch. Right. This is going on a long time. Nobody told me this guy has all these questions. Okay, let's go.
So I put little headlines for each question, and I thought this headline in itself was almost turned out like poetry, so I'm going to read the headline even though I haven't for the other questions. It goes like this. How to long for something you don't know? That's not the question. That's just the headline. So, yeah. I liked it. I have a little bit more work to do on my poetry, I guess. Anyway, so I heard on the news when the war in the Ukraine was new or had recently broken out that there were reports about infants being stolen and brought to Russia to be raised by Russian parents. So I don't know if this is true, even though I have no particular reason to doubt that it is, but just putting that in there. But for the sake of argument here, let's imagine such a child having been taken at a very early age to grow up in Russia. Now, let's imagine that her Russian parents are loving and sensitive and that there's nothing missing in her life, materially or nutrition-wise or so forth, and that she has absolutely no knowledge or memories of having had any parents other than the Russian ones. But imagine that even so, there's a streak of sadness and deep longing that she carries. So there's nothing in my life that resembles the story of our imagined child, but I still have feelings similar to hers, like I have this deep longing for something that I know absolutely nothing about, a longing for a different way of being, a longing for being part of a different kind of culture. Do you ever feel that way?
Well, I didn't hear the last part coming. So I'm a little surprised where the question went. If I have felt it the way you've described, I think it was as a much younger person. I would understand those qualities to have gathered around my youth, principally. And there was an antidote to them that came around that I didn't know existed because I didn't know the affliction was there. Did I always feel at home? No. I don't think anyone who looks like me in Anglo-North America can genuinely occupy a place and call it home. They could own it, but that's different. Belonging is an entirely different quality, as you're suggesting. So I think what happened to me, and it's my immense good fortune, was the same week that I tried to get into the ministry, you remember that, at Harvard Divinity School, and they wouldn't have me, I met an old black man. Now bear in mind, an old black man who was on the faculty at the time, who was a storyteller by trade. That's what he did. And he was teaching prospective priests how to give a decent sermon. That was what he was doing. And he met me and he said, "You should come to my class." And I said, "I can't. I've been officially disallowed." And he said, "Come anyway." And I'm thinking, this is Harvard. You just don't come. But he's telling me to come to completely disobey the rules and regulations. So I did. And for the next 7 years, I was an unofficial apprentice to this man. We never talked about it. But I performed with him off and on over a 7-year period. And I can tell you this, and I can even recommend it to you as well, the alchemy that was visited upon me took the following form. This man, in all his grandeur, he was an exceptionally funny guy, like painfully funny. But his real genius was in tragedy. He was a genius, and in that sense, a master of tragedy. I don't mean he didn't feel the tragedy. I don't mean that he somehow superseded the tragedy. I mean he was a practitioner of tragedy. He understood the tragic and its belonging in a human life, and he practiced it. He practiced the understanding accordingly. And because he did that and never told me that's what he was doing, I didn't know what I was looking at for all of that time. That's what a real good master does to you. Doesn't tell you anything, but keeps doing it on the off chance that you might wake the hell up. You never know. So this is what he did. By virtue of his genius, he stole something from me that turns out it was my prized possession at the time. What was that? He stole from me my ability to slouch. Is this an easily understood word for you? To slouch at the threshold of adulthood and claim that I'd never seen the real thing and to exempt myself from active duty because I'd never seen the real thing in a human form. So what do you want from me? And I'm sure by the time I met him, I had that desperately. This is my equivalent of some of the feelings you described, that you can't rely upon me because I don't have a feeling of belonging or solidity of place, all of that sort of stuff. He didn't give it to me. He took it away from me instead. He said, now, live without that grievance. And I've lived without it ever since. And it was never replaced by anything else. So I was so lucky. Well, blessed is the right word. But you have to know that the word blessing in English comes from a Germanic word, which is the word for blood. So the verb to bless literally means to bloody. That's its oldest incarnation. So it means if you're going to bless someone, something has to end for the blessing to take hold in their lives. And for me, it was all of the life I lived until the day I met him was bloodied as a consequence of his genius. Amazing. This stuff still happens. It sounds like a story from some medieval times, doesn't it? But it really happened. And I'm standing here, or sitting here tonight, with you because that happened. I don't know why you're here, but that I definitely know that's why I'm here. And in addition to a very kind invitation. Two questions.
Two to go. Gregory, you got that? Two to go? Your writings and teachings are to a large extent informed by your years of working in palliative care, of working with dying people. You wrote in your book, Die Wise, that this line of work revealed to you a death-phobic culture where we die in a kind of institutionalized, sedated, and well-managed terror. How would we come to dying if we were living or if we were part of a functioning culture?
Well, it's important when you're answering a question like this not to establish a kind of orthodoxy about what it would look like, what it should look like, and that sort of thing. Because don't forget, my answers come from the same place yours come from. I've never seen this in my formative years. I never saw what you're just asking me about now. So this is me partly acknowledging that and then partly saying, but I have lived since, and I've been lucky enough to be around since. And, I mean, this is an all-afternoon answer for sure, but the answer I'd give you now would be something like this. you can tell that a culture has a death-literate element to it when it's not waiting for death, when all the realities of death are present, not future. That's the simplest answer there is. There's other elements too, of course there are. There's all kinds of things that are not related directly to dying at all. But this is a dying specific question. And so I can tell you that in the places that I've seen that are alive to these things, they don't understand their dying to be the opposite or the undoing of their lives. They understand their dying to be the rest of their lives. And in that sense, dying is a very life-affirming proposition for them. Unlike where I grew up, where the only way to affirm life is to continue to live at all costs, which you would grant, that's not life-affirming. That's survival-affirming. And survival and life are two distinctly different things. Survival has some spite in it. And life doesn't seem to.
Thank you so much. The last question actually comes from a member of the audience. She's here tonight. We were emailing. I was on the train going to see you in Malmö the other day, and we were texting, and I thought she had some very interesting ideas. So I'll turn this over to her, but she's asked me to read it. So here goes. Can you say something about how sexuality is affected by a death-phobic culture?
At first, I thought the question was going to be about gender stuff. And then when the last part of the question appeared, I realized, oh no, this is not about gender at all. Okay, I'm going to tell you a vignette. This really happened. Now, it's not going to trouble most of you, which would trouble me a little bit. I'm telling you the story in order for you to be troubled by it, okay? Not bothered, a little more than bothered. Okay, here it goes. And this really happened, too. So I was working in the death trade, as I call it, years ago. And it was on what they call it, euphemistically, a multidisciplinary team. I can tell you've had the experience. And in a multidisciplinary team, allegedly there's nobody at the top, which is absolutely a joke because the physician was on top. Don't you worry about it, for sure. But in this particular meeting, somehow, you know, we're going around discussing all the patients and everybody was getting current with the development since we'd met a week ago. And one nurse, I'm going to guess she would have been her late 30s, early 40s, was relating an experience she had with an aged, dying patient. This man would be in his probably 80s, 70s, let's say 70s. Now listen, before I go on with the story, this is going to challenge some of you, okay? You're going to think that I'm advocating a certain kind of weird license for behavior. So please listen carefully, because I'm not doing that. I'm just telling you something that happened. I can advocate with the best of them, but I'm not doing it now. Just telling you a story in case you weren't there, because you weren't. So she's telling the story, and she said she reached across the man to get something, I don't know, whatever it was. And when she did so, the man just inhaled her very deeply. Just... and audibly, no? So it was not, like, he wasn't hiding it. It was very Shakespearean, you could say, moment. He just inhaled the sheer feminine life force, which is this attending spirit woman. As she's telling the story, she's not telling it like I just said it to you. She's telling it, she's so disgusted. She's so offended by what he did that she officially anointed him and baptized him as a dirty old man. That's the answer to the question. But if you'd like me to elaborate with a sentence or two, I could do it. What am I pleading for here in this story? I'm saying, what was the man aroused? I should say so. Should he be? Where does the should come from? Is she prepared to stand in for life itself in this man's arousal? Clearly not. Should she be? Is there anything in her nurse training that sensitized her to the fact that she could be the most alive thing that a dying person ever gets close to? Is this sexual? Of course it is. Are there other things at work at the same time? Of course there are. It's a mythic and poetic reality, isn't it? That has a gravitational pull, that has a physical reality to it, that belongs, it seems to me. And in elegant cultures, I think what this man did borders on the elegant, to be honest. I wasn't there, but based on the way she described it, I think it's what it was. But in inelegant cultures, you know what this kind of, the exact same impulse in him turns into, which nobody can corroborate. And I don't corroborate it either. So there's a difference. The impulse would be the same, but the lack of cultural achievedness in these matters, inflected in the direction of avariciousness and grasping and physical contact and, you know, overwhelming the distance and all of that. He didn't seem to me to try to collapse the distance between himself and this nurse's body. I don't think that's what he did. I think he gave her her respect and was alive, maybe for the last time. And there's something so honorable about it and so life-loving about it that I wish she had felt the occasion for this man's deep memory of what it meant to be physically so alive and so capable, that was suddenly, just for a moment, had come to pass one more time. And if she had been educated, she might have been able to look down at him and sit beside him, not take his hand and all, just sit beside him and say something like, none of this is easy, is it? And you know, it's not easy for us either. And we're all on the cliff edge of life, every day, all day long, or something. And that's the story she could have come back with to the team meeting. And all of us would be deeper human beings for that. So I'm telling you the story so that our humanity can be deepened in a time where there's so much seduction to not be human after all. Thank you for listening to that.
Well, we went a little bit longer than we thought, and let's...
What a shock.
What a shock.
Yeah.
I guess we need to reset the stage. Anybody needs to pee? This could be a good time to make a dash for it. And we'll see you in 5 minutes for a little bit of You'll See.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, if you assume the position of general attention, we will do what we can to reward you for doing so. And although I admire all aspects of you, if you're facing this way, it's probably best. Don't forget that nurse story now. Still in the air, no? All right. Well, we're doing something that I don't think we've ever done before, Gregory and I, which is to take a firm and clear view of the Knights of Grief and Mystery as we've come to understand it over these 8 years and all the different iterations that we've pushed through on, and do a very small, but as it turns out, probably a fairly intense version of what we've been touring for the last 3-4 months. So I'm not going to say too much about it, because I have to enter into the great mysterium tremendum of delivering on what we were asked to do. Some years ago, I was working on a book about matrimony. And like all things matrimonial, the book wasn't working out at the time. And so the consequence was, as you must do from time to time in matters matrimonial, I had to set it aside. And I'd found myself down in the southern edge of the northern hemisphere, in Oaxaca, Mexico, because I am a pulmonary refugee, you see. Which is to say, when the going gets tough and the cold comes in, I can't breathe too well, and I have to take care of myself to make it through the winter, literally. So this was the case, and I was down there, and I set the matrimony aside. It had been a couple years since Gregory and I had composed anything new. So I get in touch with him, and I said, listen, I'm down here. I got a little time to myself. Why don't you come down, and we'll just make a record? He said, okay. Down he came a week later. And we sequestered ourselves into a little mud building way at the end of an arroyo, like a canyon. We had no neighbors. Well, there was the odd wild dog and a jaguar who barked more fiercely. When the jaguar barked, the dogs went silent. That's how scary it was at night. And we were working there day and night, with no contact with the outside world for 12 or 14 days and nights in a row. We would collapse at 3 o'clock in the morning, get up at 8 and start again. Things are really happening. And we had not one record, but two that began to emerge. And there, Natalie's got them out there now. One particular morning, for some reason, one of us turned on the news. And I guess I didn't mention to you that this was March of 2020. And we'd listen to what was happening to you in this country and to the people where I come from in Canada. And it turned out virtually everywhere all at once. And it was an absolutely staggering thing to hear come out of nowhere. I don't know if you can remember the onset of the staggered understanding of what had become of us, what had befallen us. And of course, the extraordinary and almost irresistible story of what all of us did as a result of what came on. Here's what we did. I literally sat down, and my first thought was, what is this going to mean? What is it going to do? What will be the consequences for the kids? Because I knew my mother's generation was marked by the Great Depression. You could tell in everything they said, it was haunting and persistent and always there. My generation, the mushroom cloud, of course. Oppenheimer's big deal now again. That's what we lived with. But the kids, what will this be to them? What's the image? What's the sign? What's the logo? What's the brand? That kind of isolation and that kind of disrepair. So I sat down and I realized, in a moment like this, if you've got a creative bone in your body, you're not writing a get well card to the kids in a time of trouble. No. You're writing a love letter, or you better. as best as you're able. So we wrote one, and we call it Fate in 4. And this is the preamble. I'm in Athens about a month ago, and I just had a screening of Griefwalker, which we've never done in Athens before. Man, it was insufferably hot. It was some kind of industrial zone, this old industrial building, a paint supply place, or I don't know what it was. And nobody could breathe. I had to leave. And I figured lots of people were going to leave with me. Not many people were going to be left at the end of these 70 minutes, but nobody left. And finally, they opened the doors when the film was over and the Q&A was supposed to start. And I figured, okay, now they're leaving. And nobody left. And so I stood up and I did my best with the Q&A. And I realized they're not going to leave. They're staying for as long as there's something to hear. So I realized if this is going to come to a conclusion, I'm going to have to end it. And so I just walked out the door, thinking I'd figured it out. But they were one step ahead of me. For they walked out the door with me and followed me down the road, desperate to find out if there's anything left to say. It turned out there was, but not by me. In this group of people that followed me like a kind of spiritual bubble wrap down the road, there was a young woman, maybe 20 years old. She was skinny, not much to her, but she had eyes like burning coals. And when she looked at you, baby, you were looked at. That's how that was. And I knew she wanted to say something to me. And I knew she wanted me to hear something that she had to say. So I stopped everybody. And I said, yes. She said, listen. I listened to what you said. And I want you to know something. I'm not afraid to die. And when people say this to me, young or old, there's usually a lot of bravado. Indefensible bravado in there. Kind of amateur's declaration. But that wasn't there in this young person. There was something else that she hadn't said yet, which she was now about to say. No, she said, I'm not afraid to die. I'm afraid to live. And so this is for her. What time is it? Oh, it's the Anthropocene, baby. That's what they're calling it now. You know what that means? We're the center of it all. That means we got our spirit prints on everything. That means wherever we go, there we are. We can't get away from us. That's what time it is. And you know there are kids on your news feed. They're on the steps of your city hall, and they're at your UN. You've stolen our future. That's what they're saying. You understand it. You understand, don't you? That they're pretty sure that nobody else knows that the sky is falling. Just them. And that solitude is turning them inside out. Be prepared to stop. That's what the sign said. Didn't happen though. Sign's gonna change. Be prepared to be stopped. Oh, we haven't got it right. That's what made their world. We're their fate. That's how it seems. Now, if you're over 45 years old sitting here this evening, it's almost sure that you grew up with the understanding that just about anything was possible. If you could dream it, if you could want it bad enough, and you could have it, you could be it, you could do it. Everything's still possible, friends? Maybe. But most of those possible things, they don't seem likely now. That's how it is. Oh, we're going through it. And the kids, They're not going to submit to the scrutiny of their seniors another minute. So if you want to get a sense of any of this, you're going to have to try something new. No more sitting across from them, making them the object of your scrutiny. Just another moral problem for you to solve. No. You're going to have to move that chair until you're 45 degrees from them. And if you do, you're not going to see them directly. You're not going to see them clearly anymore. But you might be able to see them truly. If you do, see if you can look off into the middle distance now, in the direction that they're looking. Not see if you can see things their way. It's not them in the middle now. It's what they're seeing. And you will be staggered by the courage it will take for you just to see it, just to let it in. Young people, they're another country now. That's what time it is. So the kids figure that something has been stolen from them. What they could have been, what they could have had, what they could have done, the world that could have been, the future that could have been. The world that they imagined that we had. And that's pretty hard to argue with. All except for that future part. That's not as true as it sounds. They never had the future they figure we stole from them. It wasn't there before they were born. We don't have it either. Nobody does. Do you hear the teeth clenching then? Can you hear the teeth gnashing? Because that is one of the things that the kids are doing with their present. They are burnt now, and they are blistered by the goneness of a future that they never had. If we've stolen anything from them, maybe it's there now. Because now's the thing nobody seems to want anymore. Too messed up. Now, it's an orphan. And each day, man, the kids are going along with that. They're not protesting it nearly as much as they're agreeing to it, agreeing that they have been stolen from. So many of them seem grief-free, and so many seem grievance-drunk now. Well, that's what grievance will do that to you. That's trauma, all right. On the installment plan. But being pissed doesn't make you wise. And knowing who the bad guys are doesn't make it bearable. Doesn't make it doable. But man, it is must doable time now. That's what time it is. So I'm sitting there, I'm talking with an earth rights guy. And he's doing God's work. And we're talking about what's coming down the pipe, what they call now the near, near future. And this is what I said to him. Well, here's the thing, man. The starting point now is just too late for a lot of things. That has to be the starting point now. Come on, you've seen it yourself. All the inertia, right? The incremental 5-year plans, right? The government's opting in, opting out in the same year. It's not bad enough. That's the meter. Now you work your ass off in the meantime, all right? And I'll do the same. But bad enough. That's what we're going to have to wait for now. Seems like it's going to have to get worse. Maybe that will be the sign. And this is what he said to me. You cannot tell the kids it's too late. That would kill them. They're going to sit on the corner. They're going to self-medicate to oblivion. You got to keep them engaged, he said. And I said, engaged? I think hooked is what you mean. You mean hooked on hope. That's right. Hope spoils your taste for the way it is. It spoils you for work, too. There's nobody that hopes for the way it is. We hope for the way it isn't. Hope's got that future problem, too. Now, if you want the kids to vote for you, sure, you can tell them it's not too late. But you can't do that. Not if you respect them. And he said to me, so there's no hope then? And I said, exactly. There's no hope. None that's worth all this trouble. There's no hope worth giving up this present of ours for. And he said, so wait. The only way to mobilize kids now is to guarantee their future or scare them silly with doom? There's nothing else? I said, no, there's something else. As soon as you demonstrate the capacity to carry all this weight, that's when you get weighted down. You see, that's fate. But for grown-ups, when there's finally no hope left, that's when you leave a scent in the air of what some people did in a time of trouble, like this time. Because the people to come, Lord, they're going to need that. They're going to need to know that they come from people who are worthy of coming from. And you don't hope that you'll be worthy. You get worthy now. That's what time it is. Four. Fate. What does it mean now? Well, it means doomed now, doesn't it? It means destined and, alas, predestined to. And you can feel the cold grip of that thing. You can see the lights going out. You can feel the air leave the room. You can see the page of life being turned, being torn. Because what's the point is right there. And we could call it destiny if we want to, because destiny sounds better. But we don't mean destiny. We mean defeat. We mean it doesn't matter now. Nothing matters now. Well, that's not what I mean. This is what I mean. By the time the Romans handed this word fate to us, they meant what should be. And that is a great distance from what will be, as anybody who's been alive for a while really knows. This should. Well, it came from the gods. The word comes from fare, and it means to make by speaking. Fate. That was what their gods said. For in those days, they say the gods spoke aloud, and this world was made because they spoke, and of their words. And so long ago, the gods said this. You've heard us speak. Now, what will you do? Because their spirit prints are all over the way it is. But the fix isn't in. It's not fatal, baby. No, it's fate. And it comes all to this. What shall we do now that the gods have spoken? And we answer that question every day. And that's what time it is. Thanks a lot. Well, that's a tough thing to begin a little bit of a show with, but you can't stand here and take up people's evening and leave the kids out. You can't do it. So we didn't. So thank you for listening. Thank you.
moist morning path from the dark to the light. I am grateful for it all, for it all, for it all. For every cut and every fall. I am a shadow. I'm just a shadow. I'm the shadow. They're gonna buy it, but you can't deny it. We're only in Sweden like once. I won't even try it. We might go home crying, not dying, just trying. Oh, this is about getting you all to sing, 'cause everyone else has done it on this tour. Not the tours before that, it's kind of new.
As you can tell.
So I'm gonna make you do it anyway. I don't care what you say. Sing with me the line is.
Oh, this is good. Oh, improv, okay. Thank you very much for the evening.
A deep thank you to all of the Patreon supporters who make it possible for me to keep doing this work. Thank you, Suki Cannon, Lisette Toft, Brigitte Reppen, September Larsson, Livsring with Silje Hystad, Camelia Freiberg, Alice Hall, Peggy Campbell, Nicole Alger, and all the rest of you. Without your contributions, Campfire Stories simply wouldn't exist. To find out more about becoming a Patreon supporter, please visit patreon.com/MattiasOlson. PATREON.com/MATTIASOLSSON. Thank you so much, and until the next time.